I call to order the first meeting of our secret society, the Hermetic Order of the Orange Penguin. Each of us must take a solemn vow to deny the existence of the order, to protect the occult knowledge which only we possess, and to wage a 30 years war on the surface of the moon from which we will emerge triumphant as overlords of a new society steeped in ancient magic. Do any of you have any questions?
I guess I do.
Yes, what is it?
Why am I the only other person here?
Well, we have to be very careful about who we let in. If word of our plans were to leak out...
What plans?
Well, first you have to get elected president of the United States.
Me?
Well, yes, imagine a member of the Hermetic Order of the Orange Penguin in the most powerful office on Earth. It'll be beautiful.
Why do we have such a stupid name?
You know, you'd be surprised at how many other names are taken. There's already a Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn, a Hermetic Order of the Violet Flame, a Hermetic...
Okay, I get it.
And now we must dance and caper naked in front of the giant penguin statue while the magic lute plays...
That's it. I'm out. You said this was basically like a Zumba class? You lied.
But lying is one of our sacraments.
Gotta go.
Okay, you know, fine, beat it. But just understand that someday there's going to be a knock on your door, and a member of the Hermetic Order of the Orange Penguin will be there with an ancient stone knife to cut out the part of your brain that knows about us. Because that is how we deal with apostates.
Whatever.
So, do you want to meet for coffee tomorrow? Or?
Sure. Like... 8:15?
Cool. All right. I'll see you there. Meanwhile, here's a show about secret societies. And now the grand yolk of Egg and Spoon, Colin McEnroe.
It's true. I was briefly the grand yolk of Egg and Spoon. I started Egg and Spoon at a certain university that will go nameless, located in New Haven, because I didn't get asked to be in Skull and Bones or Scroll and Key or any of the other ones. And so I would meet by myself at breakfast, basically. All right, so we're going to be talking about secret societies today, and some of them have serious implications and some do not. We'll try to sort those out for you, although it's difficult at times. If you have questions along the way, we do hope you feel free to call in 860-275-7266, 860-275-7266. A little later in the show, you'll meet Alexandra Robbins. She's the author of 4 New York Times bestsellers, including Secrets of the Tomb, Skull and Bones, The Ivy League, and The Hidden Paths of Power. And she, in fact, is a specialist in Skull and Bones. Also, a little bit later, you'll hear from Jay Kinney. He's the author of several books, including The Masonic Myth, Unlocking the Truth About the Symbols, Secret Rites, and History of Freemasonry. But for a fabulous overview, we're going to begin with Arthur Goldwag. He is the author of Cults, Conspiracies, and Secret Societies, and most recently, The New Hate, A History of Fear and Loathing on the Populist Right. So, Arthur Goldwag, is there a way that we can sort of define our terms here at all? Is there a way that we can say what a secret society is?
Here's how I tend to put it when I talk about these things. There's secret societies as they define themselves. There's secret societies as they occur in history, and there's been many secret societies. And there's secret societies as the people who fear them define them. And they tend to be pretty discrete groups.
And actually, maybe a good way into this is to talk about the Illuminati. Most people probably know that name, but the Illuminati exists in several of the ways that you just described, or has existed in several of the ways that you just described. Maybe you can just begin with its origins, which are, isn't it like at the beginning it's like five people, right?
Well, it was never larger than about 3,000 people. Mm-hmm. It started with a man named Adam Weishaupt, who was an ex-Jesuit. He was in Bavaria. And he had the idea that the way to propagate Enlightenment values and bring down the kings and destroy established religion and bring about a rational democratic system of governance in Europe would be to set up secret cells, secret groups like the mystery cults of ancient Greece, and infiltrate existing Masonic lodges. And most of the Masons wouldn't know that they were there, but the initiates, the secret initiates, would really run things. And they would grow and spread throughout Europe. They didn't last long. They were shut down within about a decade. But when the French Revolution occurred, there were two international bestsellers that ascribed the revolution to the machinations of the Illuminati. And following that, about every 20 years, one political group or another rediscovers the Illuminati. And the big rediscovery in the 20th century was probably Nesta Webster introduced them to the political right. But the Illuminati was a real group. It hasn't existed for a long time, and it gets rediscovered constantly. And there's people now that will tell you that they run everything.
And when it gets rediscovered, I mean, it's worth emphasizing here that there's sort of a strange irony in the way that it gets rediscovered, in the sense that to whatever extent the Illuminati ever existed, from what we can tell about them, their views would have been very harmonious with those of the founders of America. They would be extensions of the thinking of John Locke and Thomas Paine and Thomas Jefferson. I mean, this is basically just kind of a club about the Enlightenment. The Enlightenment was the notion that rational understanding and natural law and apprehension of natural laws would be more important than, say, the divine right of kings, which is a pretty all-American idea, except that somehow or other here in America, whenever it's brought up, it's like they're trying to overthrow America, although to what end?
Well, I mean, that's the interesting thing about a lot of far-right thinking and a lot of principled racist thinking. One of the great documents that they use is the Protocols of the Elders of Zion. Mm-hmm. And its origins were as a its origins go back to the Tsar of Russia, and its agenda was to keep the Tsar in power and to protect the established the Orthodox Church. These are not American. These are not what you think of as the interests of real American patriots. But there has always been a tension in America since the beginning between the Enlightenment values and the religious values. And remember, we were founded by religious refugees who were in terror of the organized. I mean, they despised the Catholic Church, many of them. The group that they feared the most when they came here, you know, when the pilgrims came here, were the Jesuits. They were looking, and they saw the Jesuits as kind of the ultimate sinister secret society. Jefferson was accused of being a member of the Illuminati. Mm-hmm. And when he was already president by the time he looked into their writings, he described Weishaupt as a philanthropist, as a friend of mankind. Now, as it happens, Weishaupt wasn't a really nice person. He got a sister-in-law pregnant. He was a kind of a jerk. But philosophically, he wasn't that different than the ideas that went into our own Constitution.
So, you know, in some ways, there's a pattern. It's not a strict pattern, but there's a pattern, which is that some kind of group does exist for a while, and they're a little bit secretive. And they have codes of secrecy, and they're often interested in some kind of esoteric knowledge. And then, you know, maybe they don't persist all that much, but as you suggest, and this does seem to happen a lot, there are alternative groups or alternative groups of people who are very worried about them and who feel that they are more powerful than they probably really are, and that you can sort of plug a whole bunch of names into the sentence, "They control everything." And so it's not as though those groups never existed. It's just that they don't control everything, right?
Exactly. But what's interesting is the agenda that's attributed to them, it's often not that far from their real agenda. It's just that, I mean, there are right-wing groups now that regard globalism and the UN as, you know, the worst horror imaginable, world government, one world. That's the horror that the Protocols of the Elders of Zion calls forth. And there were groups, Cecil Rhodes had various groups that he was involved in that were looking to bring about an English sphere of power. And he had hopes that England could reabsorb the United States and that there would be this benign Anglo-Saxon rule of the world. So people look at that and they say, my God, here's a conspiracy to undo the American Revolution, to rule the world, to destroy sovereignty. You know, these are all the things that the John Birch Society fears. And again, I mean, the politics are real, but when they look at the secret societies, they imagine that all of the political things that they don't like are the explicit agenda of a group that's devoted to those things, and they paint them as though they're a satanic group, and the that's one of the consistent strands that runs through this all the time. That it is a religious framework. There's evil and there's good. Evil isn't just an adjective, it's a noun. This is what evil looks like.
We're talking about Arthur Goldwag. His book is his books include Cults, Conspiracies, and Secret Societies, and most recently, The New Hate, A History of Fear and Loathing on the Populist Right. You know, some of these groups, some of these so-called secret societies, have kind of murky origins, but ultimately seem to become attractive to there are people who are attracted to esoteric knowledge, to the notion that there's this whole non-canonical set of knowledge ranging from alchemy and magic and things that are, you know, outside the accepted, literally canonical gospels. And people seem to, I mean, people like that. It's the reason they buy Dan Brown novels, and maybe we'll come back to him in just a second. But so you have a group like the Rosicrucians. Now, help us out here with the Rosicrucians, but my understanding is at the very, very beginning of the Rosicrucians, it wasn't even clear whether the first group of them were even serious about this, but a lot of people wound up being kind of serious about whatever that Rosicrucian esoteric knowledge was. But help me out here.
Well, the origins of the Rosicrucians, it's fake. Mm-hmm. There was a book discovered that said that they had come over, they went back to the Crusades, and that they had this secret core of knowledge, and that there were a few members of this group that passed the knowledge down to each other. And in the 1700s or the 1600s, I don't remember exactly when it was, it was finally all revealed. But that's not true. I mean, we know who wrote the book, and it was a contemporary book. But the material that was in it, there was a lot of stuff that did go back to the Crusades. There was a lot of Arab magic in it. There was Kabbalah in it. And the thing that's interesting, and I mean, the Islamic magic and the Jewish magic, these traditions, they were secretive. They were highly esoteric because the people that were involved in them believed that they were real, and they didn't want people to abuse it. So, you know, you weren't even supposed to look at Kabbalistic documents until you were in your 30s. And then, you know, it was up to the discretion of the teachers whether you were somebody that would abuse these powers or whether you would use them for religion. And again, this goes back a long time. The Hermeticists in ancient Greece did the same things. They had these secret groups, and you could join a temple and never get admitted to the innermost circle of knowledge.
So if you do consume Dan Brown novels, then you might be under the impression that here in contemporary life there are a lot of groups that still participate in this kind of arcana, right? That they're interested either in extensions of the Knights Templar or some other esoteric rite, or once again some really non-canonical version of Christian faith or so. That these things are really sort of churning around and pretty active in world affairs. I'm assuming that is exactly what Dan Brown would say it is, which is fiction, right?
Well, Dan Brown is drawing on a long tradition, and the science fiction writer Robert Heinlein drew on a theosophical tradition. And theosophy is an esoteric religion that was created in the 19th century. It's syncretic. It has aspects of Eastern religion. It has aspects of mystical Christianity. But one of the tenets of theosophy is that there's these ascended masters, these perfected spirits. Some of them are from different planets, but they kind of watch over us and they control things. And I remember there was a Heinlein novel that was published in the 40s about these people that live inside of Mount Shasta, and they're telepathic and they have all these psychic powers and they influence the world. And Dan Brown chose a different tradition than the theosophical one. He chose one about the Priory of Zion. And the Priory of Zion goes back to the Templars. It goes back to it has real history about the Templars, and it also has made-up histories that the Masons wrote about themselves. He got a lot of it from a bestseller that was written a few years before his book came out, and I believe there was a plagiarism suit, or there were at least complaints. But again, he was drawing on stuff that's been in that was in the air.
All right, Neil. So there's that whole tradition of that stuff, and I think it's worth saying. I hope you're comfortable saying this. There really isn't any Priory of Zion, right? Like if you wanted to join it now or something like that,
you would have a hard time finding it.
There's nothing like that. Okay, now there are some other groups that are more real, that are more temporal in quality, less. I am assuming less religious in nature, that are sort of either internationalist groups or groups within America that sort of are cross-party and involve powerful people. And in the next segment, we'll save Skull and Bones for the next segment. But, for example, one hears of the Bilderberg Group. Now, the Bilderberg Group, whatever it is, it's not a fiction, right? There was such a thing, or there is such a thing. I mean, maybe just a bunch of people who meet, and I gather not always the same bunch of people anyway, but that's a real thing.
If you're invited to a Bilderberg meeting, then it follows that you're rich and powerful. Mm-hmm. That's what they are. They started in the 50s. They were put together by a Dutch businessman and intellectual, and the idea was to bring business leaders, political leaders, thought leaders of Europe and America together to kind of set out a framework for, you know, what you might even call global governance. Although the idea wasn't to run things, it was to coordinate. But the Bilderbergs, they don't allow reporters in their meetings, or if reporters come to their meetings, because some powerful journalists are invited to them, they're not allowed to report on them. Council of Foreign Relations, it's the same thing when they have their meetings. It's understood that it's not going to be written up. And if you're on the inside, you know, you welcome the chance to speak frankly and privately without having to worry about it reading your name in the newspaper. If you're in government, screwing up your government. If you're in business, jeopardizing your business. If you're, you know, if you think that these meetings are sinister, then the fact that they're not reported makes them even more sinister. But yeah, I mean, the Bilderberg Group exists, and it certainly is a bunch of rich and powerful people, and you could even make an argument that these are the people who run the world.
But they don't. They may be the people who run the world. They don't. They just don't run the world as the Bilderberg Group. They're just they're running the world all the time, doing what they do. So I mean, just to sort of round this conversation out, and then we'll take a break. We'll talk about Skull and Bones. I want to come back also, Arthur, at some point to the Bohemian Grove. But just to round this conversation out, Council on Foreign Relations, Bilderberger Group. I mean, one hears about them in, I think, also a comparably paranoid context, right? I mean, you don't have to go very far out onto the internet these days to find what you used to be able to find in fairly obscure periodicals and stuff like that. These explanations that everything that we see as our government, our political process, our Constitution is kind of a charade, and that all kinds of things, and the things are brought forward, events and historical developments, modern developments, can all be explained by the machinations of these groups, which are not participating in any kind of democratic process, right? That's the narrative about them.
Well, I call it a Gnostic narrative. And the Gnostics basically believed that the God that we worship, the God that the churches give us, is an imposter God, and that the real God is somewhere else. And the Gnostics know who the real God is, and they're going to defy established religion and find their way to the real God. And in popular culture, like The Matrix is the great Gnostic movie. You take the pill and you see what reality is. And in, you know, the world that you think you live in isn't the world that you live in at all. And this is behind the great conspiracy theories. This is what's at the root of all of them. The president is really he's not who he says he is. He's a Muslim socialist. He answers to a group that you've never heard of, but that goes back to Satan worshiping, human sacrificing, people from Babylonia, or there's even conspiracy theorists with very large international audiences that have traced them all back to a planetary system, and they come from a different star system, and they're actually lizardoid beings and they shift their shapes and so on. There's an English guy that pushes this idea, and it has a lot of followers.
All right, we have to take a break. Although, just before we take a break, I just want to just pause here for one more second and just sort of say this. I mean, I think maybe I speak for a lot of people when I say, well, I don't believe that everything that presents itself as public life and the business of governments and the government of business is all just one big kabuki spectacle arranged by shadowy organizations, definable, identifiable shadowy organizations like the Bilderberg Group or the Council on Foreign Relations. I don't believe that. I mean, I basically believe that the process that I see that gets reported in the press is more or less the case. But I think also a lot of people do think, without believing in all that other stuff, that there are multinational corporations that are capable of exploiting almost any kind of political climate, that many people who leave public service join these massive consulting groups that that seem, once again, you know, to be less partisan and open in the way that we like our government to be, but yet capable of exploiting events and pushing for certain things to happen. I mean, so now do I sound like the kind of raving paranoiac that you write about, or is that just sort of a normal reaction to watching events unfold in Iraq or
something? It's true. Yeah. It's true. But what I can say is that the leaders of those multinationals would much rather that you be looking for secret societies than that you be looking at them. Mm. And that's the tragedy of a lot of this stuff, is that the people that are destroying the environment and stealing from us and you know, undermining our financial system, that the truly amoral people that are helping destroy the world benefit from people looking for Satan worshipers, because they're right under our noses and they're getting away with it.
Right. Better that we should be looking for lizard people than for Jim Baker or somebody. All right. So let's take a quick break here. We'll come back. We're going to talk about Skull and Bones. Actually, Sybarite 5 sounds like the name of a secret society, but it's not. It's a really cool chamber group. I'll be there tonight. Hope you got your ticket, too. All right, so Arthur Goldwag is staying with us, but we're going to add another voice to the chorus. Joining us is Alexandra Robbins, the author of 4 New York Times bestsellers, including Secrets of the Tomb, Skull and Bones, The Ivy League, and The Hidden Paths of Power. She writes for publications including The New Yorker, Vanity Fair, and The Atlantic. So, Alexandra Robbins, you decided to investigate this organization called Skull and Bones, which is one of a group of secret societies at Yale. The secret societies at Yale they sort of operate along a gradient of secrecy and prestige, with Skull and Bones being by far the most prestigious and by far the most secretive. So, given how secretive they are, were you able to find anything out about them? I mean, would people talk to you?
Oh, yeah. I ended up speaking to, probably about 150 members of the society, and there are only about 800 living members at any one time.
So let me, first of all, I should A, confess that I attended Yale University, and B, confess that my girlfriend at the time had a father who was in Skull and Bones, you know, maybe its kind of heyday, you know, in the 40s when the OSS was forming and all the stuff that you see in the movie The Good Shepherd started to unfold after that. So so I have my own impression of Skull and Bones, and I'm going to just bring up a few ideas, and you and Arthur Goldwag can either affirm them or shoot them down. I personally believe that there is some kind of possibly informal interlacing between Skull and Bones and the American intelligence establishment, that it was convenient, if nothing else, to have a group that operated in secrecy, that swore various kinds of oaths of secrecy, and have a lot of them being people who are in a very secretive business. So I'll ask both of you, but let's start with you, Alexandra Robbins. Am I way off base about this?
Not at all, not at all. In fact, the link between Skull and Bones and the CIA was so strong during the 1960s, during George W. Bush's and John Kerry's years in the society, that CIA officials would come back to the tomb. And for the uninitiated, the tomb is sort of, it's what Bones calls its headquarters, and it does sort of look like a crypt, but they call it the tomb. So anyway, CIA officials would come back to the tomb during their meetings and spill national security secrets. The CIA was also known as, and I'm quoting a Bonesman who spoke directly to me here, an employer of last resort. If members of Skull and Bones couldn't find a job, then they could go to the CIA.
Arthur Goldwag, I mean, what's your overall impression of this? I mean, we have in Alexandra someone who's really spent a lot of time on this and immersed herself. Where does Skull and Bones, both the reality of Skull and Bones and paranoia about Skull and Bones, fit in on the continuum that you look at?
It's an elite group at an elite university, and its members went on to hold very important State Department, investment banking, and military intelligence jobs. They turn to it for recruiting. I mean, of course it's involved. But Skull and Bones doesn't have an intrinsic agenda to produce these people. It's a product of our class system.
Alexandra, does that sort of square with the way you think about it?
Not totally. Historically, Skull and Bones has only tapped people who they think will reflect honor and success and wealth back onto the society after graduation. Skull and Bones only exists to put its own members into prestigious positions. That's the whole point of the organization, unlike other secret groups such as, for example, the Freemasons, who might have some community service involved. Skull and Bones exists only for itself.
You know, one of the things that I learned, I think I can say that I learned this during my time in college, and particularly dating somebody whose father was in Skull and Bones, was that at least for a time, and I don't know if this persists unto this day, Alexandra Robbins, but for a time, the wives, the people who married Bonesmen, would be put through a very elaborate indoctrination or initiation process. And we're not talking about 20 minutes with a blindfold and somebody sticks your hand in a bowl of Jell-O. I mean, from what I was told, it was really a rather lengthy thing. Which I assume, again, was meant to shore up this commitment to secrecy, that it just wouldn't do to have one's significant other walking around blabbing about stuff that was secrets that are taken very seriously.
Well, they do want their secrets, and that is one of the reasons, perhaps, why one of their most interesting rituals is the sexual history. It's one of the first activities that new members do once they're initiated into Skull and Bones. Yale juniors are tapped in April of their junior year. They leave over the summer. They go to Skull and Bones Secret Island, which I can tell you about. In fact, you might have been to it since you dated
a Bones
Bond. Well, you probably know about it anyway. When they come back in September, each of the 15 knights, which is what Bones calls the Yale seniors in the society, must spend an evening spending several hours in front of a painting of a woman in sort of a cozy, dimly lit, dusky room in the tomb, and there meticulously recount his or her entire sexual history. I have to say, as someone who went to Yale, you can probably agree with me that I have no idea how some of these guys talk for several hours about a sexual history. But one of the reasons they do this is to forge the bonds between the members of the group, and perhaps so that each member knows some secrets about the others.
Well, Alexander Robbins, if 100 former, or I guess you're never a former, if 100 Bonesmen or Boneswomen, because they do now, I guess, have women in the society, if they talk to you, that meant 100 people or so didn't take some of these vows of secrecy all that seriously. But my sense is that collectively, Skull and Bones does take its secrets rather seriously. So how was your enterprise regarded by them? I mean, why are you still living on this earth and allowed to? Why did they use their enormous power?
Skull and Bones does not kill people who betray their secrets. Skull and Bones, I think the way to view it is probably it is one of the most impressive and proportionately powerful alumni networks in the country. Really what Skull and Bones is about is the connections that interplay afterwards, something you were talking about a little bit, sort of like secret society nepotism. They put their fellow Skull and Bonesmen into positions of power. The lines can blur, and this also gets to something you were speaking about in the last segment. I'll give you an example. Conspiracy theorists will say that Skull and Bones is a satanic mafia that operates a shadow government that is thoroughly intent on global new world order, and it forces its members to masturbate in coffins. Okay, that doesn't happen. However, when the lines blur, you can see where some of this comes from. They get the masturbation in coffins idea from the sexual history. They get the other idea from things like this. Conspiracy theorists like to say that Skull and Bones dropped the atomic bomb. Well, truthfully, there were no instructions from the tomb in New Haven to drop the bomb. However, several Bonesmen were in the War Department, hired each other so that there were several members of the secret society in the War Department at the time, and they were indeed in charge of overseeing the construction and the deployment of the bomb.
We can even name a few names.
You can see where it gets hazy.
Yeah, I mean, Henry Stimson, who played this absolutely epic role for decades and decades of American life. If you wanted somebody to sort of symbolize the kind of paranoia somebody might have about Skull and Bones, you have Henry Stimson, who's a guy who served in so many presidential administrations in the highest offices, Secretary of State, Secretary of War, former Skull and Bonesman, and yes, within the Roosevelt administration, bleeding into the Truman administration, there were guys like George Harrison, not the Beatle, but a Skull and Bones guy who was very, very instrumental in the decision to drop the atomic bomb. But I would agree with you. It didn't come from High Street. It just, as you're saying, these guys just tend to get very powerful.
And to practice cronyism.
Right. And by the way, if anybody's listening, and you know, we say this from time to time, but as far as the masturbating in the coffin, don't try that at home, even if you have a coffin at home. We don't encourage that. It's a romanticization anyway. We're talking to Alexander Robbins and to Arthur Goldwag. Right now we're sort of pausing on Skull and Bones. So when you did this research, I mean, I could rattle off, you know, a dozen or 20 names of famous people and former U.S. presidents and CIA people and stuff like that, and even the actor James Whitmore. But did you, Alexandra, find former members of Skull and Bones when the names actually surprised you?
Who surprised me? Let's see. Yeah, I mean, many of them are people you'd think. Bushes, Harrimans, Buckleys, Tafts, Bundys, Rockefeller, and Acheson. Winston Lord, Walter Camp. That was cool, actually. Walter Camp, founder of rugby, football. I mean, that was pretty neat. There was a Tony Award-winning actor who I'm not going to name because he hasn't outed himself yet. What surprised me? I think the biggest surprise was probably when John Kerry and George W. Bush were the presidential contenders.
Right.
Because if you think about it, to have two guys from this tiny secret society competing for the, you know, the position of the President of the United States. That's really incredible. 15 people per year, maybe 800 living members at any one time, and two of them were running for president. I mean, that was insane.
And Arthur Goldwag, that's the kind of thing that does trigger the kind of paranoia and the kind of speculation that you talk about, right? I mean, you know, there's a presidential election, and if you don't want to vote for somebody from Skull and Bones, you have to vote for Ralph Nader.
Well,
like
the deeper paranoia is it the Kerry and Bush, their politics seem so different, but they're not. They share the same agenda. Really, they're both about global dominance. And when you look at the tropes of the grand conspiracy theories from the John Birch Society and so on, that's exactly what they say. That they're all the same people.
And Alexander Robbins, very quickly here, you know, these people who did talk to you, did they explain to you why they talked to you? I mean, were they just kind of bored and tired with the whole trope of secrecy?
Well, many of them saw me as a kindred spirit because I was a member of Scroll and Key, which is sort of the second in line at Yale. But really, it's nothing like Skull and Bones. It's actually pretty boring, or else I would have written about that one instead. I should say, though, that probably twice as many as the number who talked to me yelled at me, harassed me, hung up on me. A journalist member of Skull and Bones threatened that he would make sure I would be blacklisted across journalism institutions in the country. At the time, I was writing for Cosmo, so I wasn't too worried about that. But I should say that while some talked to me, many did not, and many were upset.
I used to write for Cosmo, and I wasn't in Skull and Bones either. So there's obviously a theme. There is a conspiracy of some kind. All right, Alexander Robbins, thanks so much for joining us today. It's fascinating stuff. Once again, the book is Secrets of the Tomb, Skull and Bones, the Ivy League, and the Hidden Paths of Power. Hey, Arthur Goldwag, while we just have a minute or so here, I did want to ask you about another one of these groups that, as far as I know, is not sort of in any way religious or mystical. Although it may turn out I'm wrong about this. But I've heard quite a lot over the years about the Bohemian Grove. And without naming any names, there's a person heavily involved with this show. He's not present on the premises today, but he will be very soon. I wouldn't say who it is, who recently has been invited into their midst. Maybe not just exactly as a member, but as something else. And so... One hears about this. Once again, one hears about this as an organization that has a membership that includes these kind of, you know, big stakes players in business and government, some of whom rise above partisan concerns. For example, David Gergen, who seems to be able to serve presidents from any political party, is reputed to be a member of the Bohemian Grove. What the hell is the Bohemian Grove?
It has an interesting history. It was started in San Francisco. It was kind of modeled on the Century Club in New York, which is writers and intellectuals and important cultural figures. Jack London was an early member. Frank Norris was an early member. Ambrose Bierce, I think, was involved. And it was kind of progressive-leaning. Mm-hmm. And they bought this camp to the north of San Francisco in a redwood grove, and they had these summer meetings there. And after about, they invited businessmen too to pay for it, and after about 30 years it was mostly businessmen, and the businessmen invited some culture figures. And in the early 50s, well, when Eisenhower was considering running for president, and the hardcore Republicans were supporting Taft, Eisenhower went to Bohemian Grove to meet with Herbert Hoover and these other Republican power brokers and show them that he was a good guy. And by then, Bohemian Grove was, you know, was where you went to meet the really important movers and shakers in the country. Some journalists said that the Bohemian Grove is a burning man for old rich dudes or something like that. And that's probably a fair description of it. There's some rock stars that go there. I think Steve Miller goes there. Maybe one of the members of the Grateful Dead goes there. But what they have some rituals and some customs there.
Do they dance naked in front of a giant owl?
Well, they have a big mask that they do called the Cremation of Care. And when Alex Jones sneaked in the year 2000, he filmed some of this mask and he presented it as a Babylonian blood ritual. And at least one person was so terrified by it that he broke in after he saw the Alex Jones videos and went there ready to kill people. And it was in the winter, so there was nobody there, but he burned down part of it. Mm-hmm. He got arrested.
All right. Well, I like Burning Man for rich old people. That sounds about right. All right, let's take a little break here. We've got the Masons yet to cover. That'll be our final segment, so stay tuned.
Call to order another meeting of the Hermetic Order of the Orange Penguin.
What is this?
A meeting of the Hermetic Order of the Orange Penguin.
I thought it was a staff meeting.
I know, right? It's actually a great way to meet secretly because everybody bags the staff meetings. This is actually a secret society that'll one day rule the moon using ancient magic.
Well, if we're not going to talk about the keycard problem or the staff parking lot, I'm leaving.
This is so not going well. Today's show was produced by Betsy Kaplan and me. Our secret intern is Anna Novak. Katie Talarski is our executive producer, and Greg Hill tweets for us a WNPR call-in and appeared in our introduction. The part of Bill Curry was played by Alistair Crowley. For stories, show pages, links, and photos of the Faith Middleton Show staff dressed up as 18th-degree Scottish Rite Masons, visit our secret webpage, WNPR.org. On tomorrow's show, the nose gets ready for Sochi. And now, back to call.
All right. We have so many secrets here. I had no idea. So Arthur Goldbach is still with us. And in some ways, we've saved for last the organization, as far as I can tell, that in some ways kind of provides a kind of sterile framework for a lot of the other things that we've been talking about. But maybe all of this can be unlocked by Arthur and by Jay Kinney, a former cartoonist, the author of several books, including The Masonic Myth, Unlocking the Truth About the Symbols, Secret Rites, and History of Freemasonry. So, Jay Kinney, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Just to begin at some arbitrary place, we actually did like 3 or 4 years ago a show about Masons. We had a whole bunch of Masons in here. They seemed perfectly nice, maybe even a little bit on the boring side. And so that's sort of, on the one hand, that's sort of my impression of Masons. It's kind of this organization which, you know, maybe you might have a few firecrackers in there once in a while, but basically it's a bunch of guys, you know, a bunch of people, and nothing all that exotic or special going on. And then there's this whole other thing that, you know, their symbols are on our dollar bill and stuff like that. So how do we reconcile these two pretty obvious strains of thought about the Masons?
Yeah, it's really puzzling, and that was part of the reason that I set out to do the research to write my book. I would say that the mystique, the notion that it has all these amazing secrets, is a leftover from many centuries back when the Masons were actual stonemasons, and they had initiatory rituals, and they had trade secrets, which they wanted to keep. So only legitimate, knowledgeable Masons could build cathedrals and things like that. And I think that just sort of carried over down through the years when it finally just became a fraternal order and didn't really involve stonemasons anymore. That secrecy was still kind of a attractive mystique that attracted a lot of people. So I think it's partly just the Masons' own love of having a mystique about themselves.
But, you know, Arthur Goldwag, one thing that I even noticed when you were talking about some of the other groups, when you're talking about the Illuminati, and I think this is also true of the Rosicrucians, that somehow or other, some of these other groups that are fond of esoteric knowledge, they kind of nest inside the Masons, right?
The Masons have absorbed a lot of these mystical groups. Yeah, they've taken possession of the Templars, in a way they've made them a part of their history. And there is, take like an occult writer like Manly Hall. He would say that there's outer Masonry and inner Masonry. There's esoteric Masonry. Or a figure like this in the Scottish Rite, Albert Pike, the who wrote The Morals and Dogmas, it involves a tremendous amount of occult and mystical and Kabbalistic and Gnostic literature. Not all Masons are into this stuff.
Yeah, and so Jay Kinney, it would be possible to be a Mason for one's entire adult life, to go through whatever initiation there is, whatever swearing to secrecy there is, and then maybe not encounter the kinds of stuff that Arthur's talking about for the rest of one's days on Earth, right?
Yeah, I think that every Mason has their own interest areas, and some are just in it for the socializing. Some are looking for esoteric knowledge, and I don't think it's necessarily the best place to go find it, but that is part of its attraction for some folks. And in my own case, I was mostly intrigued by the history and the research potential. So, yeah, you can certainly be a Mason and never run into much in the way of esoterica.
So, Arthur Goldwag, since your role on the show today has been again and again to take my own murky and fragmented understandings of these things and put them into some kind of perspective or framework. So my murky understanding of the Masons includes this kind of notion that, yes, they are secretive and that various important people have been Masons. I have this notion that George Washington was a Freemason. And I also have this notion that some of their iconography is, in fact, present on the dollar bill, the pyramid with the eye in it, stuff like that, is in my mind anyway, some kind of Masonic symbol. And for that reason, I perhaps imagine that at one time or another, they had significant influence on something anyway. So enough influence to get their damn pyramid on our dollar bill. So put this one into perspective. Where should I come down on all this?
I'm not sure. I'm not sure that the pyramid is strictly Masonic. There was a kind of vogue for Egyptology stuff. Masons were into that. Maybe it was strictly Mason. Maybe it just kind of overlaps with the same cultural strand that was going on. The same zeitgeist.
And as far as the other stuff goes, is this again just a situation where various important and powerful people tend to join organizations, and so it's kind of a coincidence if I find out that George Washington or Ben Franklin or somebody was a Mason?
Well, both of them were Masons, and it wasn't that coincidental in that neither of them were real churchgoers. Both of them were real Enlightenment people, and they moved at the top of their society. Masons were kind of the voice of they were the expression of secular humanism in those days, and they weren't lower class people. They were educated people. They were interested people, and they were also, the Catholic Church has never liked the Masons. They don't like their secrets because you're supposed to confess. They don't like their ritual because it's an alternative to Catholic ritual. And, you kind of have there's the Protestants and the Catholics, there's religious people and non-religious people, and the Masons are sort of a group that established
We're actually going to have to wrap there. I hate to interrupt you, but we're like literally out of time. I have just enough time to thank you. Thank you intensely, Arthur Goldwag, author of Cults, Conspiracies, and Secret Societies. We'll be back tomorrow with The Nose.
This is Kion Wolf. I call to order one last meeting of the Hermetic Order of the Orange Penguin. Nobody's here, right? Finally. The only real way to keep the secret is if I'm the only one that knows, so...
Oh, excuse me. Is this the Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn meeting?
No. This is the Orange Penguin. That was a close one.